Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Bentley, and Judge Cleary, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, November 13th, 2024. We have five cases on our calendar for today. First three are set for oral argument, first of which is A24-0426, Jacob Thomas Carlson versus Dawn Marie Piper. Counsel for appellant, when we begin, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes for respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. The podium in the middle, there's a button underneath to lower and raise it so you can speak into the microphone, and please do. This is being recorded and it is also being live streamed. The recording will be available to the parties within a couple days if you want to go back and listen to the oral arguments. When you approach the podium, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Courtney Sibo-Sabika, and I represent the appellant Dawn Marie Piper in this matter. This appeal is from a district court proceeding designed to determine the best interests of a now five-year-old girl, Fallon Carlson, pursuant to Minnesota Statute Section 518.17. The main issue in this appeal is whether this court is required to step in and correct errors committed by the district court in analyzing Fallon's best interests. This appeal follows a five-day trial that took place over a period of 3 months in the summer of 2023 in Hennepin County. Prior to trial, the referee appointed a parental consultant and a parental evaluator. These court-appointed parties recommended a parenting time plan. Father did not produce any sort of rebuttal expert to rebut the recommendations of the parenting time plan that was recommended. But on January 17th, 2024, the district court issued findings of fact, conclusions of law, and an order ordering joint physical and legal custody of Fallon on a 50-50 parenting time schedule, rejecting the parenting time recommendations made by the court-appointed parties. This order abruptly expanded the time the child was to spend with her father from 30% to 50%, essentially overnight. By this point in time, Fallon's custody had been litigated for 2.5 years, which was more than half of her life by that point. For a child who had been through what Fallon had been through up until that point, rejecting the recommendations of the parental evaluator who was appointed by the court to spend hours and hours of time with Fallon and her families is a red flag. The statute shows us that the legislature prioritizes a child's support, consistency, safety, and basically for everyone to focus on her and her needs, not only her age-appropriate developmental needs, but her special needs. The district court failed to do so here. Fallon was diagnosed at the age of 3 with other trauma, stress, and deprivation disorder of early childhood. And the question here is, what has the district court done to ensure that Fallon's best interests are supported?
Can I just ask you a quick question, please? Going back to your discussion about the parenting evaluator and those findings, is it your view that the district court had to somehow defer to those findings or couldn't disagree with them? I mean, I take it you don't go that far. So what is then the district court's obligation to consider those findings, and what would the court need to do if it were to disagree that it didn't do here?
Correct. So yes, there is no deference that is a court afforded to a parental evaluator. Here in this case, what the district court was required to do was, of course, and I mean, I don't even take it so far as to say, well, what does the parental evaluator say? I think that's really helpful here. I think the plain reading of the statute is what is most important here, and the focus, which was totally off the best interests of Fallon. So I think the parental evaluator had lots of great information. If the court wanted to ask the parental evaluator questions during her testimony about what the recommendations were and then make specific findings for why they were not appropriate, I think that would have been helpful. But I think ultimately the main focus here is that the focus was all wrong. And the parental evaluator had the correct focus. She was looking at this from Fallon's perspective. The district court was not. So I don't know if that helps, if that answers the question, but that's kind of how I don't think it's deference. And I think the parental evaluator here is really helpful and important, but I don't think it's the determining factor. I think just looking at the plain reading of the statute and the facts in this case is the most important thing to do.
Counsel, I have a more basic question before we get into the merits, and I'm sure you will be getting into them. But first, was there any post-trial motion filed for the district court to reconsider its decision?
No, there was none that was filed, Your Honor. There were not for requesting further explanation on the findings or for a new trial or anything. So, and I realize that that was a comment that or an argument that was made by the father in his responsive brief. For the reasons set forth in our brief, I don't think that that's important or necessary here. I don't think that it would have helped, to be honest.
Well, I don't think the issue is whether or not it would have helped. I think the issue is whether based on case law, and you know, I looked at the Frank case and the Sauter case, and the Frank case seems to state that if issues, including findings of fact, are not challenged, this court does not review it. And Sauter seems to stand for the proposition if there are procedural concerns and those aren't, or evidentiary concerns, and those are not challenged, we don't review it. So why are these issues not forfeited and not even properly before this court for consideration?
Well, because there are no procedural concerns here.
Right, that's Sauter, but oh. Frank seems to say that if findings of fact are not challenged, that those issues are then forfeited on appeal if there's no post-trial motion filed for reconsideration.
So Frank is not applicable in this case for the reasons, and I'll just grab my brief here. For in our reply brief, Frank is not applicable to this situation. I mean, first of all, the facts of this case, there's substantial evidence in this court, in this case. I mean, the record is sufficient, I think, for the most part. And so there's not anything that we can do with those facts. There were really no challenges that were to be made against those facts, against the record at that time, post-trial.
Why not? Why couldn't you have said, just square with all due respect, I think you got it wrong in terms of your findings of fact. You don't seem to go into, you know, the physical, medical, et cetera, needs. You're using language that doesn't seem to be in the statute at all. It seems like there could have been the challenges that are being raised now. It seems like those could have been presented to the district court to give the district court the ability to correct any errors and avoid any appeal.
Well, they could have been raised, but they were not required to be raised. And that does not preclude appellate relief at this point.
What case law do you have to support, contrary to Frank and Sauter and other cases, that the failure to raise a post-trial motion still allows appellate review? And why and overcome the presumption that those issues are forfeited?
So I cited the Clifford case and the Alpha Real Estate case. And again, I discussed the Frank case. In that case, the fatal fact was that the appellant had not requested a district court finding on an issue that it was appealing. So in Frank, there were issues that were being appealed that were not raised at the district court level. Here we have a very robust proposed findings of fact, conclusions of law provided by the mom in this case. Every issue that is on appeal now was raised at the district court level. In Frank, that was not the case. So that's the major distinction here. And also, I mean, this could have been raised in a pretrial, or excuse me, a pre-appellate brief and in a motion practice here at the appellate courts, and it was not raised at that point. It was raised in the responsive brief. So I will just briefly go through. I realize I have about 6 minutes here, so I'm just going to go through as quickly as I can the different factors and why the district court committed clear error here. Factor number one, the district court was required to assess the physical, emotional, and other needs of Fallon and the effect of the proposed arrangement upon Fallon's development. And again, as Your Honor pointed out, there is a concern here with replacing the word basic, replacing physical, emotional needs as specified by the statute, a plain reading of the statute, with basic needs. And the Minnesota Supreme Court has shown us how we can replace verbiage, and this is not an appropriate replacement. Basic needs are food, shelter, clothing, medical care, and certainly the record shows father is more than happy and willing to provide food, shelter, and clothing to Fallon. The issue is who is supporting her development.
So just a question on this point. I read the decision differently, but maybe you can explain me why this isn't right. That the term basic needs was to maybe shorthand, maybe not the best. It just shows clarity is a good idea, but still shorthand for factor one, which was kind of the needs that apply to all children, regardless of not necessarily this child, but, you know, these needs that apply to everybody as compared to factor two, which talks more about special needs, which would be specific to this child. So the, you know, basic needs, meaning the ones that apply to everybody, factor one, special needs are factor two. Why do you think that's not an appropriate way to read the decision?
Well, and you're right, Your Honor. I would say it is okay for the court to use illustrative terminology to explain why the court is coming to its decision. So it's okay to replace. I mean, of course, it would be an absurd exercise to just repeat the statutory language and then apply the facts to it. The concern here is that basic is not a good encapsulation of all of these different needs. And specifically on the proposed arrangement, specifically on the effect of the proposed arrangement on Fallon's development. That is not a basic need. That is going above and beyond. And I think if the legislature had wanted to just say basic needs are all that are required, that's what the legislator would have done, and they didn't do that. Here they specified all of the ways in that we need to determine what a child's best interests are.
But the statute does also, it talks about physical, emotional, but also other needs.
Yes.
So it's a little bit of a catch-all. So why isn't the term basic needs, which seems like to be a catch-all, why isn't that sufficient? Especially when, isn't that argument really form over substance in terms of what was the substance of the district court's discussion on the needs of the child?
So, yes, basic is a catch-all. Other needs is a catch-all. But physical and emotional add to that. So that's the problem here, is that there's a complete...
So basic, even though that's a catch-all, why doesn't that cover physical and emotional as well?
Well, okay, maybe catch-all isn't the best way of describing it. Oversimplification, maybe. Generalization, I suppose. But again, if the legislature had wanted us to just look at basic needs, that's the terminology that would have been included, and it's not.
Counsel, putting aside the basic needs debate, how much of this is really your disagreement with credibility determinations? Because that's how it appears to me very often in your discussion here.
So I am not in a position to disagree with the district court's credibility determinations, and I'm not asking this court to do that at all. What I am trying to do is to look specifically at the statutory language and see how the facts that are in this record go to that language. My attempt, and I hope I'm doing a good job of it, is to put the focus back on Fallon, because I think there was a real problem here and that the referee was not focused on Fallon. There was all this distraction, this distracting testimony and evidence about matters that really probably were not useful or relevant. This was a 5-day trial over 3 months. I'm sure credibility played a big part of this, but red flag again, I consider to be a red flag when the district court is starting to analyze the party's best interests, which is what the district court did in one of its factors, instead of Fallon's best interests. And so, you know, whether or not the district court, I'm not going to say one way or another who was more credible, and I understand the district court has the right to do that, but it has to be in the context of the priority of the statute, which is Fallon and her best interests. So that's how I read this. But no, you're right, Your Honor. I am in no position to ask this court to change any credibility decisions or challenge them. Just going through quickly, again, and I think our brief does a good job of outlining all of this, but there are reasons why the district court committed clear error and did not specifically really have not only the heart of the statute in mind, the best interests of Fallon, but then did not seem to actually read through the factors and analyze them in an appropriate way. And I included a number of references to other district courts who have analyzed this differently, and I know that those are not precedential. I'm not asking the court to follow those, but it just gives a nice, I think, illustration of how a district court can take a step back, can say, okay, maybe I don't like one or both of these parties, but how do I do what the legislature wants me to do by reading the statute and applying the facts to the statute, putting the child first? I realize I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel, and you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal as well. Counsel for respondent, you have 15 minutes. There's a clock on the podium as well, I forgot to mention. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. Abby Sundberg on behalf of respondent Jacob Carlson. As appellant's counsel notes, this is a custody dispute that centers around the party's now 5-year-old daughter, Fallon. After over 2 years of litigation, 5 days of trial, and proposed findings submitted by both parties following trial, the district court conducted a detailed 10-page single-space analysis of the record under the best interest factor set forth under Minnesota Statute Section 518.17. Throughout the district court's analysis, the district court addressed multiple allegations propounded by appellant against respondent that the district court ultimately found to be at times baseless, at times irrelevant, and at times even aimed at gaining a litigation advantage. Following the district court's analysis of the record under the best interest factors, the district court found that joint legal and physical custody, as well as equal parenting time, is in the minor child's best interests. As a result of the allegations propounded by appellant that the district court found baseless or irrelevant, the district court also found it appropriate to grant respondent $25,000 in conduct-based attorney's fees because appellant's allegations unreasonably extended the length and expense of litigation. Appellant now challenges the district court's custody determination because the district court failed to believe her evidence over respondents. Appellant also challenges the fee award because the district court declined to strictly enforce the procedural requirements of Minnesota General Rule of Practice 119. All issues before the court today are subject to an abuse of discretion standard of review. Because the record supports the district court's findings and ultimate determination that joint legal and physical custody, as well as equal parenting time, is in the minor child's best interests, and because the district court acted within its discretion in declining to strictly enforce the procedural requirements of Rule 119, respondent asks that this court affirm. First, as stated, the district court properly conduct a 10-page detailed analysis of the minor child's best interests under Minnesota Statute Section 518.17 to arrive at the conclusion that joint legal and physical custody is in the minor child's best interests. This is supported by the record. First, the district court, as was discussed by appellant's counsel, took great care to address the minor child's interests. The district court relied on testimony from both parties to show that both parties are knowledgeable of the minor child's allergy issues, the minor child's mental health issues, which are being addressed in therapy, which respondent testified he supports. And the district court took great care to acknowledge the testimony of both parties showing that they are well aware of what this child needs and are dedicated and intelligent parents.
Counsel, on that point, I have a question. regarding the district court's findings. And it seems that the district court made some inconsistent findings by stating that, quote, the parties have been able to co-parent effectively. But then it later commented that they, quote, have no real history of successful co-parenting. And it seems that the district court relied on their ability to co-parent effectively to support joint custody. How are we supposed to square that conflicting findings by the district court?
I think that's a fair note, Your Honor. The only way that I can read that portion of the district court's order is with respect to the remainder of that paragraph, in which the district court details the ways in which the parents have not been able to effectively co-parent. I believe that may have been just an inadvertent omission of the word not in the ability to effectively co-parent, as the district court's remainder of that paragraph illustrates the ways in which the parents have not been able to effectively co-parent. But what I think is critical about that portion of the order is that the district court notes that if one parent were to be awarded sole legal or physical custody, more harm would be, there would be more harm resulted to the child than if joint legal and physical custody were awarded. So I think the district court may have just inadvertently had a typo, but ultimately the remainder of its findings show that the district court thought that these parents had a history of not being able to effectively co-parent, but even so, joint legal and physical custody was appropriate because sole legal and physical custody would be detrimental to the child, or more detrimental to the child than joint legal and physical custody. And I think that also is the result of the district court's detailed analysis with respect to appellant's allegations against respondent that evidenced a pattern of attempting to withhold the minor child from respondent. This occurred before the litigation began, and it occurred throughout litigation. And the district court took great issue with that pattern. And in fact, that is in part why the district court ultimately granted $25,000 in conduct-based fees. So even if the district court would have found that sole legal or physical custody was appropriate in this case, it's not clear that the district court would have sided with appellant on that issue.
So what are we also supposed to make as a procedural question? The father didn't file a motion for the attorney fee award. Why was it appropriate for the district court to grant that request without a proper motion before it?
So the procedural requirements of Minnesota Rule 119 under Gully v. Gully are not, the district court is not required to strictly enforce those procedural requirements. In the comment to Minnesota General Rule of Practice 119, the comment notes that the procedural requirements within Rule 119 are not meant to limit the discretion of the district court. It is mainly intended to expedite those fee requests. So the district court acted within its discretion in not enforcing a formal motion. And appellant's main concern regarding the fee request is a due process rights issue. And the district court properly allowed appellant to submit a written objection to the fee request. So before the district court made its decision as to the fee request, it had both parties' positions on that issue. And was able to still make the determination. I would also note that these sorts of fee requests, conduct-based fee requests, are dissimilar to need-based fee requests in that a party may know at the outset of litigation that they will require fees to help them litigate that dispute. But conduct-based fee requests can arise at any point throughout litigation, as they did in this instance, in which appellant brought an issue the weekend before trial that the parties then had to litigate throughout trial. So the district court retains this discretion to handle fee requests in the way that it sees fit so that it can deal with those sorts of timing considerations that may make matters of formal motion practice more difficult.
Can you help me understand the basis for the $25,000 award? So the district court's explanation is rather short. Right, as to what the basis for 20. So how are we as an appellate court supposed to review whether that was an appropriate amount?
Well, I would just note that under Kaminsky v. Hackett, which is not precedential, but still I think informative, there is no case law, as I have seen, nor that appellant cites, that requires a itemization of time entries to support a conduct-based fee award. The district court is required to detail why it's arriving at those at a conduct-based fee award, but does not need to itemize the time entries that support that fee award. And I would also just note for the court that my office reviewed the time entries that respondent submitted with his fee request and found at least $40,000 could be traced directly to time entries that related to the conduct that the district court took issue with in granting those conduct-based fee award. So even if this court were to send that issue back down to the district court, it's not clear that a smaller value of a fee award would be the result. So the district court simply just wasn't
required. You had asked for $100,000, right?
Correct.
So, I mean, the court did some whittling of that amount that you're referencing.
I think that is goes to the district court's language in its order saying some of the time entries were nondescript. How I make sense of that is that as some of the time entries were nondescript, the time entries that were clear were able to be added to the fee award that resulted in the $25,000.
Could you address the issue about the filing of post-trial motions and whether or not the challenges that to the district court's decision were preserved or for appellate review?
Yes, absolutely. Our position is that they were not properly preserved for appellate review. As I read appellant's briefs, there are many findings or lack thereof, or I should say many issues that the district court did not sufficiently address in appellant's eyes that appellant would now like this court to rely on in overturning the district court's order. Because of that, there is, as I see it, a sufficiency of the evidence challenge to this district court order. And under Frank and Sauter, the appellant was required to bring that issue to the district court and allow the district court to more thoroughly flesh out its record before it, more thoroughly flesh out its decision, and allow this court more evidence to review upon appellate review. I would also note that
To stop you there for a second. So, the Frank decision, I guess I'm curious for your view on whether that applies to findings that weren't made at all or issues that weren't raised before the district court, whereas what I understand your opposing counsel to say is that here at least everything relate to findings that the district court made. There's nothing that wasn't before the court, almost would they be required to file a motion for reconsideration or a motion for amended filings before appellate review? Or so, and maybe to that point is like, what are the specific then issues that were not raised and brought to the district court's attention the first time around that you find here are being raised for the first time?
I don't think that is, that's not my reading of Frank. Frank has the fact pattern in which the court notes that the parties did bring these issues there was an issue of the parties bringing those findings to the district court first, but that's not what Frank turned on. The issue was when the district court fails to make findings, the party must bring a post-trial motion.
What findings did they fail to make? Because the district court made findings under each factor, right?
We thoroughly think that the district court made sufficient findings to support its decision. To the extent that appellant thinks that there were insufficient findings, I would say that there are moments throughout appellant, for instance, the whether the district court properly considered the effect of the proposed parenting arrangement on the child's development, that would be a sufficiency of the findings argument. Whether the district court properly addressed domestic abuse allegations, that would be a sufficiency of the findings argument. So to the extent that, finally, the time entries issue to support the fee award, that would be a sufficiency of the evidence or the findings argument. And to the extent that appellant's case rests on those issues, appellant was required to bring those issues to the district court first.
But if we, to your point before about your argument is that the court made sufficient findings, would you say that the court made sufficient findings as to whether there was domestic abuse?
Yes.
So if the court made findings on that seems to me different than Frank. right, where there was no finding made.
Yes, correct. I would say that our sufficiency of the evidence argument is to the extent that appellant relies on findings not
other
made.
Findings.
Okay. Yes, but to the extent that appellant thinks that domestic abuse simply wasn't addressed at all, we would disagree with that and think that is appropriate for appellate review.
So it sounds like you're somewhat agreeing with respondents' argument that they may have forfeited the issue of whether or not there are sufficient findings and remanding potentially for sufficient finding for reconsideration by the district court for sufficient findings. And issue is, so those issues have been forfeited, but what the issues remain then are simply whether or not the district court's findings of fact and conclusions of law are supported by the record.
Absolutely.
Would that be fair to say?
Yes, okay. That would. Which, yes, as you note, we believe that the record is replete with evidence that supports the district court's findings. Again, the district court may have, as Judge Cleary points out, made credibility determinations that appellant contests, but the record supports those credibility determinations, and the district court acted within its discretion in making those credibility determinations after the course of 2 years with these parties and 5 days of trial. Respondent believes that the record supports these findings and that the district court acted within its discretion in making a $25,000 conduct-based fee award, that award is also supported by the record. And for these reasons, respondent asks this court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I guess I'll start with the last point here, which is talking about the sufficiency of the findings. As an example, this domestic abuse issue. So the question is, are we saying that there are insufficient findings here? No, because we can glean from the record that we can assume the district court took into account the evidence that is in the record. In this case, the problem is that there was testimony of domestic abuse, and it was unrefuted. So the question becomes then, if there is this testimony that domestic abuse occurred as defined by the statute and it's analyzed in our brief and it's unrefuted, then this is clear error in saying that this factor leans in favor of the father.
Why is that clear error? Because the district court, even if testimony is unrefuted, that doesn't mean that the district court cannot find that testimony to be not credible and say, you know, I heard the testimony, but respectfully, I don't agree with it. And so I'm rejecting that testimony, and therefore this factor is not met.
So again, then, because there is testimony and evidence that's been provided and it does satisfy the elements of the statute, the district court is free, of course, to reject that or accept that. It needs to be explained, of course. So this is, of course, an issue that occurs, but it is not dispositive of this case. So the main issue in this case is what the focus is and who the focus is on. The focus, is it on credibility? Okay, if the focus is on the credibility of the parties, that's a big problem, because we need to be focusing on what's in the best interests of Fallon.
But that's part of the district court's role, is to make credibility determinations, or the fact finder's role. And here, the fact finder is the district court. And so why isn't that part of our review to determine whether or not it's a credibility determination or whether it's an application of the statute to particular facts? And if it's a credibility determination, as Judge Cleary said, then we defer to those.
Of course. And again, we're not asking that to be reviewed here. I look at this case as a case that, again, with 5 days of evidence, there's absolutely no need for even one more minute of this case to be reviewed by the district court. There is sufficient evidence. The record is robust here. The issue is, did the district court lose sight over a period of 3 months, 5 days of trial, of what was really at issue here? Was the district court annoyed by what was going on? Credibility, yes, it plays into that. But is that clouding the vision? Is it clouding the judgment of the court, which is as the statute very clearly, I think, very plainly requires us to do, to look at what the plain language is. And we're not asking for a novel interpretation here. I'm not proposing any sort of crazy interpretation of these statutes. I think we look at the statute and we see whether or not the district court answered these questions. I want to touch on this $25,000 piece. Rule 119 is very specific. If you're going to award more than $999 in conduct-based attorney's fees, there must be a motion along with it. This was made in the proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law, along with an affidavit that was submitted, I believe, 3 weeks after trial. I think the deadline was 3 weeks after trial to submit all the documents, to submit the proposed findings of fact. Slipped in along with that was this affidavit. So I don't...
Since the challenge seems to be one of due process, what would you or your client have done differently had it been a formal motion versus the letter?
Well, a formal motion, she would have been able... First of all, she would have had the time to respond if she would have procedurally been allowed.
But there was like a couple of months that went by, right? And didn't... I thought there was a response via letter.
There was a response via letter. I do not believe that that was invited by the district court. My understanding is that that was very hurriedly written. I could be wrong, but my recollection of this issue was that it was one of those things, we've got to get this in before the district court makes its ruling here. There was no procedure. There is a reason for these rules. There's a reason you're given 21 days and 7 days to respond. That wasn't available here.
But was there any request for a hearing on your part?
A request for a hearing on that issue? No, I do not believe that there was. I see my time is up unless the court has any further questions.
Nope.
Thank you.
No further questions. Thank you very much for your oral arguments as well as your briefing. We really appreciate that. I'm sure your clients do as well. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you both. Thank you.